Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight number 98. I'm Steve Litchfield in very croaky and cold-filled form, but I'll struggle on. Rafe's going to do most of the talking, I hope. Rafe, you there?
Yes, I am, and everyone knows I like talking, so I'm quite happy to help you out there, Steve.
Yeah, well, Ewan's been being Mr. Uber Blogger over at Le Web this week, so we've been holding the fort. Rafe's been doing some All About Symbian-related trips in and out of London. Do you want to just say where you've been, Rafe, and any significant outcomes?
Yes, I've been in London twice this week, actually. One of the interesting ones, I went along to something called the Symbian Stammsitch, which is, Stammsitch is, as I understand it, is a German word for sort of the regulars table in a pub. And the Symbian Foundation are holding every second and fourth Wednesday of the month, they're holding these Stammsitch events where they invite the community to come in and discuss with Symbian Foundation employees various topics of interest to the community. And the one I particularly attended was sort of the about the media and Symbian's relationship with it, you know, talking about, you know, why Symbian's been getting some negative press recently, what aspects of the platform they should be pushing out to the media, you know, trying to get some community participation, getting some ideas, you know, similar in some ways to the model of ideas.symbian.org, get people contributing to the foundation. They want to get in as much feedback as possible. And I mean, obviously the first thing to say is it's very typical of the new Symbian model of openness. And, you know, it's open source in both the actual code, but actually in some ways the way it's being run as a foundation is also open source, very much more so than any other platform. Particularly, you know, the obvious comparison is with the sort of Google controlled Open Handset Alliance, where, you know, getting the contributions in and that kind of thing is much, much less frequent. But also it's a big contrast to the old Symbian that was fairly conservative and monolithic. And I thought it was a great thing to do, and I'd encourage more people who have an interest in the community to go along. It's also, of course, an opportunity to meet some of the people from the foundation, good chance to network with those people, make useful contacts. And they'll be running more of those after Christmas, and we'll try and add some details onto the site about that. The second trip into London was actually to hear about more about the Ovi store from Nokia VP George Leandros, who was talking a little bit about where the Ovi store was going in the future and some of the sort of story behind it. I guess we can talk about that later on in the podcast.
Back to news now. You may have seen us on the site already, but just in case you haven't, very briefly, Skype has now been released in beta form for S60 third edition feature pack. Two phones, and there's no fifth edition version yet, as promised for the N97, though that is coming in the first quarter of next year. Why it's taking them so long, I do not know. Rafe, have you tried this yet?
Yes, I've had a quick go with this, just to add that it's also for S60 third edition feature pack one phones, and it's only the early set of the S60 third edition feature pack two phones. Incidentally, the reason for this is because the VoIP and some of the voice stuff actually changed. There was almost a silent upgrade to 3.2.1 for some of the later S60 third edition phones, or the most recent ones.
Is this a byproduct of the product of the fact that this has actually been in development for about 3 years now, and they've basically been working with old code?
I suspect it's partly that, but essentially there would be one version for these set of phones, and then there would be a second set for the sort of more recent phones that have the more up-to-date SIP stack within the phone. Although Skype isn't, you know, strictly SIP software, the way it will be integrated in the phone will use the sort of the SIP part of the software stack within the phone. So yes, it's partly that, and I suspect the N97 version, which we should be seeing very soon, it was promised for Q4 of this year, will also sort of address some of the other S60 5th edition phones and some of the latest S60 3rd edition
I remember it being promised for quarter three this year, and then it slipped.
Yes, that's probably right. Originally at MWC, I think at Nokia World, it was said to be heading into quarter four. I mean, these things have been delayed, but it's very good to see this actually come out. And it's worth pointing out that in the version that's been released, it is in beta, but it's a completely standalone client. But it's quite functionally rich in terms of being able to do things like Skype out calls, which, you know, previous betas which have been Java based haven't been able to do. And it also, you know, you can do things like add to your credit, you can access your voicemail, you can get calls from an incoming Skype number, so you can sign up for a geographic number on Skype, and that will work as well. as well as do things like call forwarding. So it's a pretty comprehensive solution. So if you use Skype a lot, actually this is a pretty good implementation. And given you can get this running on phones that you can get now secondhand for about £100, this is actually quite a realistic way of picking up a Skype handset if you just want Skype with some sort of advanced functionality in it. The other way of doing that is, of course, getting something like the Ink Phone from Three in the UK, and there are other sort of USB type handsets, but this actually offers richer functionality, and it's true Skype in the fact that it's going over the network, it's not being diverted to a PSTN number. And so the quality I tried on this was pretty good, calling out to a landline, for example, over a Wi-Fi connection. I would be hard-pressed to pick out the difference between that and a regular cellular call. Over longer distances, from a phone to a phone, it didn't seem quite so good. But then it's difficult to know. I was calling the other side of the world, so it was a long way away. And I think it's very much dependent on the connection you have at both ends, as is typical with Skype calls in general. But it does seem to be pretty robust at this stage. So definitely worth one keeping an eye on. And as you say, there is this one coming for later versions. And in contrast to this version, that will be more fully integrated. And that's kind of the only downside, is you have to make a decision to use the Skype application rather than having it sort of embedded within the telephone application of the phone itself.
Yeah. I love it when people talk about restrictions and limitations on hardware and saying, if only the speed of light was faster. Talking about communicating with the other side of the world. It's the speed of light, for goodness sake. How can that be a limitation? But it's a sign of how far we've come as mankind, I think.
Well, I mean, the idea on your phone that you can actually make a Skype call and call someone on the other side of the world without really any real problems. I mean, yes, you know, and do it all for free is really quite incredible. And, you have to sometimes take a step back and to go wow at the technology, especially when, as I say, this is all going over a data. So impressive stuff. It's worth pointing out, of course, that you can do this already on Nimbus and you can do it on Fring. I think the benefit of this is people will recognize the familiarity of the Skype interface and the sort of the brand, and it is a bit simpler than those things. Although I understand, I think moving on to the next news topic, that Nimbus have also been releasing an interesting feature this week that you've been playing with.
Yes, they've released a new version of their Symbian client. This is Nimbus with industry-first home screen notifications and sophisticated Twitter functionality, which basically means they've bolted on a gravity-like kinetic scrolling Twitter front end with home screen notifications. It works okay. It's not as slick as Gravity yet. Bear in mind, this is Nimbus' first version with this type of add-on, this first type of interface, so I'm expecting that it will improve. Gravity, though, it still remains the gold standard in terms of slickness. Both programs, Gravity and Nimbus, but both use a fair amount of resources in terms of RAM at the moment. So I'm hoping that both of these reduce their requirements, especially for things like the N97 and N97 Mini, which are particularly RAM-challenged. But watch this space. I've yet to try it on a fifth-edition device for real. Their servers were down yesterday after they released the product, and they only came up later in the afternoon, so I've just got it available on a third-edition device at the moment. But we will report back, and I'm sure the Nimbus people will keep on releasing new versions.
And it's worth pointing out that Nimbus is absolutely free to use and free to download. So people will probably like to see the fact that there's another solution they can use for Twitter. And typically there's going to be quite a good match between people using IM and something like Twitter. You know, probably something of a cross-marketing exercise from Nimbus there.
There are certainly an incredible number of different ways of accessing Twitter on a smartphone. You're spoilt for choice, that's for sure. Okay, next news item, very briefly, Nokia flagship stores. Apparently four of them to close down, although one of these is going to just be relocated in Sao Paulo. London, New York and Chicago are to go. You've been looking into Nokia's strategy here. What's your overall verdict in brief?
Well, I haven't been able to get too many details on this yet, but what I was interested in, I mean, obviously it's a bad headline for Nokia when you get a story like their flagship store closing. But I think this actually reflects, rather than sort of a failure in general for Nokia, which I think some of the media is presenting it as, this is really Nokia admitting that its sort of concept store strategy hasn't really been as successful as it wanted it to. It's not getting the return on investment. I mean, these stores, you know, cost several million to set up and run. You know, something like the Regent Street store in London, for example, has 30 plus staff. And although it wasn't around selling the devices as such, obviously you could go in and buy them SIM-free, it was much more about sort of creating a brand experience that Nokia could sell out. They just, I don't think they've had the footfall that Nokia would have hoped, and therefore it's not really cost effective to keep running them, and they can put the money elsewhere. So I think it's a shame, because I do think having a concept store that you can go into and see all the latest products is a great thing, especially when most mobile phone shops just have those plastic dummy models. But if it's not reaching enough people, there isn't much point in keeping it open, and maybe you're better served by, say, improving the online shopping experience, which some people have complained about, or putting more sort of demo pods, you know, Nokia branded demo pods into phone shops, where people can go and try out the latest devices, and when they can see a lot more of them. I mean, for some of us, you know, it's the opportunity to go and see the latest device. You know, for example, the X6 is now in the Regent Street store, complete with Christmas decorations. But for the majority of people, they'll be wanting to try out other handsets. And, you know, put them in, say, the top 100 car phone warehouse stores, and you'll probably be able to do that a lot more cheaply and get a more effective return. So, yes, on one sense, I'm sad. I mean, the only thing I'd say is I think Nokia maybe could have handled the statement to the media a little bit better. I mean, in the US, for example, they said they felt that they'd achieved sort of better awareness in the US market, which is maybe true, but it doesn't seem like entirely the full truth about why these are closing. And as I say, I think it's down to the fact that this concept retail strategy just hasn't really borne the fruit that they're expecting it to do so, and it's a business decision to close it down. Whereas I've seen some people commenting on Twitter and other blogs that, you know, it's just one more hallmark of the decline of Nokia, and I think that's rather a short-sighted view myself.
Yeah, they do have, and I quoted this in the news story, 600,000 other relevant retail outlets around the world. But I think the Regent Street store, which I did visit on numerous occasions, did rather get compared to the Apple store one too many times. And it's Microsoft have been opening up flagship stores, for example, around the world. And these have also been unfavorably compared to Apple. When a company like Apple does the flagship store concept so well and so brilliantly, why trying to compete, especially when your shop is directly across the road? So I'm not altogether surprised by this.
Yeah, it's not a particularly favourable comparison. And of course, you know, as you say, there are many, many mobile phone shops out there. And, you know, people immediately make the association, of course, with the iPhone. But it's worth pointing out that the Mac stores sell a lot more than just the iPhone. Indeed, as I understand it, the majority of iPhone sales actually take place in the traditional phone retail channels, either over the web or car phone warehouse or O2, and of course now Orange and Vodafone shortly after Christmas.
Which Nokia have plenty of presence in anyway.
And Nokia have far more presence in there. You go into any mobile phone shop in the UK, I mean, a good case at the moment is the Nokia 5530, which is the sort of budget touchscreen phone, is now selling for £100 in Carphone Warehouse, plus a £10 top-up. I think that's on T-Mobile, I believe, and also a couple of the other networks, which is fantastic value for money. And, of course, I had a quick chat with some people the other day, and they were saying, yeah, that's sort of disappearing off the shelf. People are almost using it as a stocking filler, and that's a, you know, complete contrast to something we'd have seen a few years ago, where a smartphone was a pretty expensive item. You wouldn't have been getting it on pay as you go for under £250, and you know, that £100 price barrier really psychologically important.
Yeah, let's look. Just think about that 5530. I've got one sitting next to me at the moment, which I believe you paid for, but there we go. It's a fully fledged touchscreen smartphone with a reasonably decent sized screen, including Wi-Fi. And the only thing it really lacks is GPS. The camera in it is not too bad. And all for £100, which is something like one-fifth the cost that a top-end smartphone was, so the N95 8GB was selling for SIM-free and unlocked 2 or 3 years ago. And this has most of the functionality for one-fifth the cost. I think that's stunning.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if you then look at the next model down, which is coming out, you know, after Christmas, which is the 5530, that actually adds the GPS back in again, I believe. So, you know, we're going to see a lot of models around this price point. And so I think it's that price barrier, you know, much like the $99 or the $199 in the States, is kind of psychologically important. Once you dip below that £100 mark, people are, it becomes not an impulse purchase, obviously, but it's a very different, you know, thing to spending £200 or £250. And, you know, for people who aren't sort of European-based listening to this podcast, pay-as-you-go doesn't have the stigma that it does in the States, you know, pay-as-you-go is referred to as prepay in the States, and I think more than 50% of the European market is on pay-as-you-go, and I know, Steve, you're on pay-as-you-go.
Yeah.
And so the potential the addressable market for pay-as-you-go phones is absolutely enormous. And seeing smartphones get into this space. And by the same token, you know, we've the T-Mobile Pulse, which is an Android device, I think that's now down to about £150 or so. And that's, you know, another good example. And I would expect that actually to do very well and be, you know, a really good seller for the Android platform. And people sometimes miss this out when they're just looking at the high end, you know, the N97 minis, the iPhones, the Motorola Milestone, or the Droid as it's called in the States. And it's important to remember this other end of the market, which is volume, which ultimately for a company like Nokia is what they're going after. And especially Symbian, it's yeah. the vertical platform play, not the horizontal platform play, which, you know, the iPhone is all about a vertical platform, as arguably BlackBerry is too, whereas Symbian and Nokia are far more a horizontal platform. And that has very important implications for how you implement your business strategy and what might be considered a success versus a failure.
Yeah, it sounds like you're linking Slinkly into a comment back from the Nokia Capital Markets Day, which happened just over a week ago. Why didn't we comment it on in an Insight podcast? And it was very... I struck by some of the pie charts and the graphics that came out of that, pointing out just how much Symbian is actually expanding within Nokia's world over the next 2 or 3 years. And yes, the MIMO 6, quote, mobile computers are coming in at the top end, but overlapping with that slightly and extending right down, as you say, down to the higher-priced pay-as-you-go handset market, that Symbian will rise to encompass all of that. So I would actually, and funnily enough, despite people predicting that Symbian is doomed, I would actually expect Symbian's market share in terms of sales numbers, actually, they could even rise. Do you think that's realistic?
Yes, I think it possibly is, because there's been a bit of decline recently, and they may be able to recover some of that. It's difficult to say, because at the same time, we're also going to be getting more Android device and the competition is going to continue, but certainly the proportion of Nokia's portfolio that is Symbian powered will increase over the next 2 years or so. And you're quite right, MIMO is essentially establishing a sort of a new market area. I mean, just as the same way as smartphones did, or the Symbian smartphones did, going back to things like the, particularly the N series, you know, they established that kind of converged multimedia phone. And MIMO is actually really about mobile computing. So in one sense, it's replacing Symbian, because Symbian might have been expected to do that in the past. But the ground that Symbian has before is still going to exist and actually will expand, because it's, you know, moving down the consumer curve to become, as you say, you know, away from early adopters and technology leaders or young explorers, as Nokia calls them, into that bigger mass market. And what really struck me from Capital Markets Day was the number of times Symbian was getting referred to. And I think this was partly a response to all the criticism in the media that has been happening recently, where people have been, and Nokia effectively said, yes, we know there's some problems with S60 5th edition UI, and we appreciate that we need to move with the market, and we're working on that. They showed off some of the concepts about how they're improving things. You know, the big example, of course, for Symbian 3 is removing the double tap, which I think is perhaps the most frustrating thing for people. Elsewhere, the UI is not as bad necessarily as people sometimes suggest. I do think there's room for improvements, but we'll come back to that later. But very interesting to see that. But the big message was kind of that Symbian is becoming our primary platform and is actually going to displace Series 40. It's not that Series 40 and Series 30 are going to disappear, but it will be pushed, you know, into the lower cost handsets. And Series 40 is going to continue to be innovated. It's going to add touchscreen support and dual SIM support over the next 2 years. But Symbian will become the primary platform, because this is the way that Nokia can create an ecosystem, not just for the high-end smartphones, but as I say, as a horizontal platform across a very broad portfolio. And for Nokia, as it has always been, it's really a volume game. And, you know, if they can get to that stage, and there's obviously a lot in the execution, then they're pretty much unparalleled because of their market share. So a developer will be able to, you know, create applications using something like Qt that will run on both Symbian and MIMO, and will, you know, that will be more than 65% of Nokia's portfolio, possibly even more. And okay, in absolute shipment numbers there will be a difference, because obviously at the low end you ship many more phones than you do at the high end, but you'll be reaching a far bigger market segment than you will be with the individual vertical platforms like, as I say, BlackBerry, Windows Mobile, iPhone. Android's the interesting one because I think it wants to be a horizontal platform, but at the moment it's very much a vertical platform. It tends to be in high-end devices, with a few notable exceptions, I should say. But there's a lot of unanswered questions in terms of how Android develops that split between the high and the low end, the versioning, the compatibility between versions, et cetera, et cetera, which Symbian has gone through in the past and continues to do so. So Capital Market Days, you know, the really, really big push behind Symbian, and obviously MIMO being up there as well, you know, which I think is exciting as well, because it's probably the way for Nokia to address this question of how do you compete at the high end? Well, in MIMO, they have a vertical platform that can potentially compete with the high-end Android devices, with Windows Mobile, with iPhone. I don't think MIMO's there yet. MIMO 6 will be a big step in the right direction. But with Symbian, what they've effectively been trying to do up to this point is compete against vertical platforms with something that has increasingly become a horizontal platform. And clearly, it's not possible to be as flexible or nimble when Symbian runs across a big range of devices, when you're competing against something that's, you know, very focused and is able to, you know, customize quickly, update new releases, and be very focused on that one bit of the market, whereas Symbian covers a much bigger thing. So, you know, people have talked about, is MIMO a good thing for Symbian and Nokia? Well, obviously, Symbian would like to be everywhere, but I think that's probably unrealistic. So in terms of a strategy for Nokia, I do think MIMO as the vertical platform to compete with the high-end devices, but then Symbian, which ultimately will be on more devices, and I think MIMO will very much act as an incubator for Symbian for a lot of the service and software ideas, especially given the cross-platform nature of the developer tools. And, you know, in terms of the long-term plays in services, you know, things like OviStore content, but also Nokia messaging, Nokia maps, you know, yes, the actual revenue per user for Nokia might be less on the Symbian device than something like MIMO, and indeed the margins on the hardware as well. But because there'll be, you know, five times as many Symbian devices, maybe more than that, I'm pulling that figure out of the air, of course, the overall revenues will be far greater on the Symbian devices. And as we, at least we forget it, Nokia is a volume company that encompasses the whole market, where so much of the discussion debate is focused on those vertical markets at the high end. So very long answer, sorry, Steve.
I think we're going to have to clarify this whole horizontal versus vertical thing in an editorial on the site, because I feel that I'm struggling to grasp some of the concepts, and I think something that's pictorial and diagrammatic might help here.
So I should just say what I mean by a horizontal market. If you think of a long rectangle stretching right across all the different types of devices you have, so, you know, everything from the cheap non-touch and touchscreen phones like the 5530 right up to the N97 mini and the high-end E-series devices, that's one platform running across all of those, and so it's horizontally spread across that portfolio. Whereas you look at something like the iPhone, the typical Windows mobile phones, and also at the moment the Android, they all clump around one type of device, which is the tablet touchscreen, sometimes with a QWERTY keyboard, but they're all very similar in terms of the market positioning, and they tend to be relatively expensive, and they're stretch out like a long rectangle the other way. And so that's what I mean by the difference between a vertical and a horizontal platform. And similarly, you could look at BlackBerry, and the reason it's kind of called vertical is it often has the services and the software built on top. So in the case of BlackBerry, that's obviously the messaging. In the case of the iPhone, that's things like Apple's
Mobile Me,
thank you very much, Steve, but also the application store, where Symbian's horizontal. Now, as it happens, Nokia does build stuff on top of Symbian, like the Office services, but Sony Ericsson is doing their own store, Play Now Arena, but actually beneath both of those is the common Symbian platform, so it's spread horizontally. Similarly, also for, you know, all the devices in Japan, they build their own stores on top of their own set of services. So it's not, you know, it's not unified set of services in the same way you get on, say, RIM devices or on the Apple devices. So hopefully that explains it in voice form. And yes, I will do an editorial talking about this, because I think it's a key difference between the platforms. And Symbian is the first open platform to successfully become really a horizontal platform in the mobile market. And that does have very important implications for how you look at it and how you analyze it.
Yeah. The other pie chart that grabbed my attention, I did chat about this in the phone show chat audio podcast that I do with Tim Salmon, but talking about Nokia's Symbian smartphone form factors come 2011, and I was very struck by the fact that QWERTY-only devices are still going to make up 25-30% of their sales figures, in 2 years' time. Now, I've been looking at the Nokia E72. I know you've got one as well. A lot of people have been saying that this is just incredible. How can you still keep talking up and saying some nice things about these devices with tiny 2.4-inch quarter VGA screens? And the fact that Nokia see these devices as having 25 to 30% of their entire sales in 2 years' time, I think just reflects how popular this sort of candy bar, QWERTY thumb keyboarded, BlackBerry-like form factor is. And
Absolutely. I mean, you only need to look at BlackBerry, which pretty much every BlackBerry device, with the exception of the Storm 1 and Storm 2, is in that form factor. Yes, there's some half QWERTYs and a few exceptions, but predominantly the sales are of those QWERTY devices, and that's, you know, as we know about, BlackBerry has about 20% market share in the smartphone space, so don't underestimate that. And that pie chart was interesting, and what caught my eye also was the sort of the rise of the hybrid device, which combines both QWERTY and touch together.
And I think N97 and N97 Mini.
Absolutely, and also I think we'll see things that maybe are in something like the E71 form factor, you know, the kind of the tablet form factor with a keyboard beneath, but are also touch. You know, that's interestingly in the Japan market, you have the typical, you know, tends to be flip phones, but also some sliders as well, that have a keyboard, and sometimes it's 12 key, sometimes it's QWERTY, but they're hybrid in the fact they have the touch devices. Yeah. And personally, I think that's probably the form factor of the future going forward, when you can, to a certain extent, combine the best of both worlds. And that has some interesting implications for how UI is designed in the future. So I look forward to seeing more about that. And I think the pie chart Nokia showed was sort of percentage of the portfolio, and the 12 key, what we traditionally think of as the phone, and, you know, it shrunk down to, I think, I don't know, 20%, say, or something like that.
I think
like
it was less than that, net down near a 10%, which surprised me, but it's not.
But I mean, it's worth pointing out, this is percentage of the portfolio. There may well be, it may not be matched in sales, obviously. I think the other thing that was really interesting coming out of Capital Markets Day was a statement. I saw this in a Reuters report, but I think it was also in the live stream, that Nokia would be cutting the number of smartphone models in half in order to better focus on the individual ones. So it would be down to something like 10 or 15 models as opposed to 20 to 30. And people have complained a lot about how the Nokia devices don't always feel finished or fully tested. So I think this is a big step forward. It's positive. There's obviously risk associated with it, because you may not be able to reach every niche so successfully. But I think it's probably a good idea to have 10 devices that you've focused on a bit more, spend that little bit more time polishing than doing 20. So it'll be interesting to see how that pays off and how much that's borne out in reality. So I think that cutting down the actual number in the portfolio could be just as significant as some of the other things we've been talking about.
Yeah, so assuming that, just plucking a figure out of the air, that in 2011 Nokia released, say, 9 or 10 different Symbian smartphones, and assuming those pie charts were a percentage of their range, then we're probably looking at two E72 style candy bar QWERTY devices, maybe with touchscreens, maybe without. And I think that the short answer, the reason these things keep getting made, is because people like them. Are tremendous. Probably if somebody comes and says, look, this is awful, the screen's too small, then buy a different device. Many other people will say, this is perfect, it's exactly the right size, it's got a QWERTY keyboard, and it fits in my pocket.
Absolutely. There's a reason that the E71 has sold 10 million units, and that's because it's actually more than 10 million now, an awful lot of people like it. And, you know, it's, again, being able to see outside your own preferences. And a lot of people still prefer that form factor over something like touch. And that will continue to happen even when you move to the hybrid devices, which I think will happen in time. The RIM, and indeed there are lots of those QWERTY devices out there, and we've also seen them on the cheaper devices, things like the LG KS 360, thank you, and also on other devices. So, I think, you know, people think QWERTY and immediately think BlackBerry, but that, you know, it's not necessarily restricted to just that form factor. There's the side slider, the vertical slider, the horizontal slider, and that kind of thing. I'm expecting to see a lot more of that. And I think actually it's a market trend that's been going on for a while, so it's not really a surprise, but it was good. It was very interesting to see Nokia making what were very firm commitments about, we will achieve this, we will release two milestones in terms of UI, Symbian 3 and Symbian 4 based, obviously, and we will be, we want to get to 300 million of the active Ovi users, we want to get $2 billion of revenue from services by the end of 2011. These are very concrete figures that people are going to be able to say they've either met them or they haven't. And it's interesting to see them being, laying down what I would say are very strong guidelines in terms of this is what we want to do. And if they don't meet them, people will be able to justifiably say they have failed to meet their targets. And I think this is a great way of responding to the, Nokia is failing, Nokia is doomed, because they're, in one sense, pinning their heads to the wall. If they don't make it, it will be very obvious and people will shout about it and there will be a real financial impact on the company. But they seem absolutely convinced that they're going to be able to do it.
Less people think that we are all about Nokia, as we have been accused. Let's move on slightly to... I met up with Lee Williams earlier in the week, and I put the interview up on the site, which you'll have read by now, and I know Rafe's been reading it. And Lee was particularly keen to emphasise the role of other non-Nokia contributors to the Symbian Foundation. And Lee himself uses a Satio now as his main device in conjunction with the Nokia E72 for some messaging work. And before the last time we met up with him, he had a Samsung i910 HD, and he was talking up the Qualcomm and the Fujitsu involvement in the foundation. So it's not all about Nokia in the Symbian world, trust me. And Rafe, what were your any overriding impressions after watching the interview and reading it?
What I thought was interesting, I mean, it's worth pointing out that this is obviously Symbian putting their viewpoint across, and I think it's probably fair to say all about Symbian is a friendly audience for them. So I thought he was being quite robust and combative about the way he approaches, and that's pretty typical for Lee Williams, having interviewed him and talked with him many times in recent years. But I actually think it's absolutely the right thing to do, because you need to get the message out there about the Symbian Foundation doing something different. It's working hard. It's actively seeking contributions. It's actually in a much better position than people put it on. So, for example, I'm sure there's something that a lot of people will pick up on. He was talking about the UI not being as bad as it's portrayed. And actually, that's, I think, a fair comment. You look at the non-touch version, it completely dominates the market for consumer smartphones. And there's a reason for that. It's because it works. It's not necessarily as flashy or as whizzy as people would like. And even with S65th edition, it works for a lot of people. That's the reason something like the 5800 has been able to sell. Some might say it's in spite of the UI, and I have some sympathy for that. But it's important, as I mentioned earlier, to realize that I think the UI is evolving. And he talked about some of the declarative UI, which is actually something that comes in Qt, which is very exciting and actually potentially for developers enables some really interesting solutions to happen. But I also thought the way he was talking about some of the contributions coming in, using the example of CalDev, for example, from Sun, was interesting to kind of push the Symbian message of we're looking for contributions, we're different to what have been done before. And actually pushing back against some of the media messaging that's coming in from elsewhere about, Symbian Foundation doesn't seem to be going over where it's being led. And you need someone to actually, put across Symbian's point of view. And people should listen to it. Clearly take it with a pinch of salt, because there's a certain message that they're trying to project. But just as anyone would listen to, Google's presentation about its new platform, or Microsoft or Steve Jobs' keynotes, you should be listening to what the foundation are saying, because they are still dominant in the marketplace. And with Nokia talking Symbian up as they were at Capital Markets Day, they will be so for the foreseeable future. So ignore the Symbian Foundation at your peril. And actually, companies should be looking at it, thinking, how can I work with this organization to make the most of my business? And I think that's what he projected very well. I'm sure we're going to get some pushback on the interview, people saying, but I don't agree with this, don't agree with that. But bear in mind that this is the Symbian point of view coming across, and we don't see that all that often in the media. So I'd encourage people to go and read it, and it will tell you a lot about how the Symbian Foundation is thinking. And people are probably going to go, they're not aware of the problems. Believe me, they are aware of the problems, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to come out and say, right, throw up our hands. No, they're working on it actively, and they know the next couple of years are critical for them. And I think that comes across very well in the interview.
Yeah, earlier on the podcast, you were talking about OviStore and having visited it. Now, OviStore is a virtual store. How can you visit a virtual store? What was that about?
Well, what I meant by that was, I had a briefing with one of the Nokia executives, and they were talking about where OviStore had come from and where it was going. And essentially, there's going to be the next release of OviStore, which will happen sometime in the spring. And when I say next release, I mean next major release. And the story behind this is that when they were setting up OviStore, it was basically about consolidating all the different Nokia services together, things like download, but also widgets, Mosh, and they were try and buy programs, for example, on MMC cards and that kind of thing, you know, and they wanted to consolidate something altogether, and that produced OviStore, which was based on many of those legacy technologies. But at the same time, they realized they needed to start thinking about what came next, and so effectively there was a parallel program going on building up a content store from scratch. And so the, you know, if you like, OviStore as it forms now is kind of a combination of all those disparate services before. And what we'll see next year, that will be a fairly seamless transition, and you won't necessarily notice, will be this thing that's built from scratch. It will be 75% new, roughly, and with legacy components, which will then get phased out. So you'll have something completely new, which will result in a refresh in the consumer experience in terms of things like the UI, what you can do. You know, in time, we can expect things like in-application payments and some of the other fancier features. Also, when that sort of core functionality is fixed, because we're all aware that there's issues with OviStore, they'll then start adding in some of the other pieces, like the recommendation engine, the more advanced model there, you know, the location element, and probably last of all is the social element. And those last three elements will work best when they actually have the core working properly and lots of active users. And you know, they also talked about the strategy in the long term, how in some ways it's a volume play, and that OviStore has a profit and loss statement that Nokia wants to obviously be positive in the longer term. But rather than go on too much about that now, I will write this up for the site. But the sort of the news here is really that, you know, they were being very open in explaining the story behind it, and, you know, acknowledging that OviStore has problems at the moment, but they're working on it very hard, and there's actually reasons it is the way it is right now, and there will be a refresh of it coming in sort of spring 2010 that will you know, start to solve many of the problems. It won't be a flash bang thing, it will happen gradually over time, but, you know, very encouraging in terms of the long-term future of OviStore. And I felt much more positive about OviStore having had that briefing and heard about some of the details, and I look forward to sharing it with everybody on the website.
Absolutely, I look forward to that as well. A bit of housekeeping before we finish up on this podcast. Now, many of you have reported that with the All About Symbian Insight, you've had it repeat halfway through or a certain percentage through, so you get, say, 10 minutes through, and then the whole podcast starts again. We think that the problem is that there is a S60 podcasting has a bit of an issue sometimes when trying to resume an interrupted download from our server. And whether the bug is in some weird combination of factors that we haven't quite puzzled out yet, whether it's simply as simple as a bug in podcasting that's been there for yonks and Nokia haven't got around to fixing, whether it's something that's been slightly broken in Apache server itself, we don't know. But my advice to you, and this is to avoid the interruptions. Now, podcasting by default lets you either manually update all your podcast subscriptions or go online twice a day or update every hour. I set mine to update twice a day, and I set those two times a day such that I know I'll be within range of my home Wi-Fi network. The end result is that every single day I don't get interrupted downloads, and I've never once seen this repeating podcast problem on any podcast on any of my phones, not once. The people who are reporting the problems tend to be people who are more mobile and they're in and out of office networks, or they've got their podcasting set to refresh once an hour, so it tries to pick up on Wi-Fi networks to update podcasts halfway through the day, and of course the podcasts get interrupted, then they have to get resumed, and sometimes that resume goes wrong. So can I urge people, set podcasting up to update twice a day, make sure you're within range of a network, and let us know if you get more reliable results.
And I would add that if people continue to have problems or are having problems, do let us know, because it would be interesting to have some extra data points. As far as we can tell, this is actually a problem that seems to affect the S60 third edition feature pack 1 phones the most, and is less of an issue on some of the later phones. But we would like to hear more about it if you are having problems. And I do apologize for it. And I've had a look at the Apache server and some of the things, and I can't see any obvious problems. But if there's an expert out there listening to this, would welcome any information you may have. And I apologize for the interrupted experience. And the typical pattern here is worth saying that it tends to be that the podcast starts halfway through, the download gets resumed, and it starts again from the beginning. And so you get to hear our dulcet tones introducing the podcast more than once. If you want to download it directly from the server, that will work fine, and I know a lot of people do it that way. But as I say, do get in touch to let me know if there's any problems. You can email me, rafe@allaboutsimeon.com, or get us on Twitter at AAS or at Rafe Blandford. And as I say, I apologise, but as Steve said, there's some advice there that should solve the problem if you're having it.
I'm sure. I wonder if some cynic hasn't already pointed out that we repeat ourselves enough in terms of content that, you know, how can you tell that it's repeating? How is this different from a normal podcast? No, I mustn't go there. My voice is gradually giving up. You can probably tell on the podcast. Ewan, in case you're wondering, is off being Santa Claus today at his daughter's school, which has rather shattered an illusion because I now know that Santa Claus isn't real. So I'm a bit disappointed by that. So it's way over time, and I'm going to go off and crawl back to bed with a lemsip. But it's goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield.
And goodbye from me, Rafe Blandford.